Okay, so what I wanted to do today was to start with, while people are arriving, is to give you, once you've enjoyed my wonderful presentation picture, is to give you a spelling test. And once we have enough people, then we can actually start with the tutorial. So I will say things and you have to write them. You see, for example, Rossetti, Christina Rossetti. You write Christina Rossetti. No, wrong. That terrible thing you're telling me by telling the answers. Two S's, two T's. And Christina? Yeah, you're going to be thinking about it more, aren't you? See, Christina, good, with CH. What about Percy Bysshe Shelley, especially the Bysshe? No, well, by Percy Bysshe Shelley. Percy Bysshe Shelley. No? Percy Shelley. Ah, but you need to have the Bysshe in. That gives you an extra point. Hi, Julio. What we're doing while we're waiting for people to join us is we're having a little bit of a spelling test. Diego is not acing it so far. okay, Julio, can you spell Wordsworth? Ish, by the way. Julio, can you spell Wordsworth? Diego, can you spell Wordsworth? Can anybody spell Wordsworth? Oh dear, the door's open. Marina! ¿Puedes cerrar la puerta? Se ha abierto solo. Wordsworth, good, 1 point. Okay. The tiger. The tiger. Oh, Julio didn't like that. He's gone. Good. 1 point. Coleridge. Coleridge. Very good. Brocklehurst. Oof. Brocklehurst. Yes, oof. Definitely oof. No? Oh. Brocklehurst. Brocklehurst. Okay. The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Hi, Elena. While we're waiting for people like you to join us, we're having a little bit of a spelling test. We've lost one person so far by our spelling test, but anyway. The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, very good. Okay, Elena, can you spell the Windhover? Can you spell the Windhover? The Windhover, the last poem that we looked at last week by Gerald Manley Hopkins, whose face you can see on the screen, looking very Windhovery. No? Diego, the Windhover. Yes, 1 point, the Windhover. You don't need to put a question mark behind them all. Okay, Elena, Doppelganger. Was ist Doppelganger? I don't know how to say, how do you spell doppelganger in German? Doppelganger, but that's the cheaty form. So the real form, the form where you get extra points, is Doppelganger. Doppelganger, with an umlaut on the A. Okay, what about Künstlerroman? Künstlerroman. Künstlerroman? No, Künstlerroman. Künstlerroman is the story of the development of an artist, as in Aurora Leigh. Okay, Charlotte, as in the Lady of. Charlotte, as in the Lady of. Yes, good. One L, two T's. St. John, as in St. John Rivers. St. John, as in St. John Rivers. No? St. John is written like that. St. John, I'm afraid. Okay. So, we've only got five people, but I didn't care. I'm going to start. So, there you have what I have. Whoa. Close, please. Noticed over the years as the biggest problems. Getting the Barrett right with the double-double in Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Gerard Manley Hopkins with an E before the Y. Lord Byron, less of a problem, I think. Ode on a Grecian Urn. Grecian. Percy Bysshe Shelley, we mentioned. Rhyme with the Ancient Mariner. St. John Rivers, The Tiger, Tintin Abbey. People seem to have a lot of problems spelling Abbey correctly. As in Jane Eyre or John Eyre. Helen Burns, 1L. Brocklehurst, however. Ode to a Nightingale. The Reeds, Eliza Reed, Sarah Reed, John Reed, I think. Coleridge. There's the cow. The Lady of Shalott, the Wind Hover, To a Skylark. Alfred Tennyson with a Y. Christina with an H. Rossetti with doubles. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Dorothy Wordsworth, not Dorothy. Aurora Leigh, spelled like that. Misogyny. Künstlerroman Doppelganger. Okay, so. I will probably post that separately on the forum anyway, just so that you can make sure you're happy about all of those. Right, well, what I'm going to do is a mixture of talking about ideas and then putting things in chronological order. I hope it works. I don't know. It is the result of my week of thinking about all of this, and we'll see if it works or it doesn't. So our period, well, that period that we're interested in this term is 1790 to 1880, can be characterized as the incorporation of ideas thrown up by the American and French revolutions into mainstream thought. There is a revolt against the restrictive patterns of the past and ancient privileges. Above all, it is the age in which rights are universalized. Women, children, laborers, slaves, and animals are all increasingly perceived as having rights. Women are increasingly recognized as capable of refined thought. Think about Jane Eyre and what she says to Rochester, and capable of creating serious literature as a result, and as being the deserving subject of literature. So we have people like Tennyson writing about specifically women protagonists and things like Mariana and the Lady of Shalott, or the portrait of the Duchess in My Last Duchess. Children are increasingly considered innocents, and childhood is cherished. And we see that in Jane Eyre, in Aurora Leigh, in Great Expectations. By the way, there are some sort of mentions of Dickens and Great Expectations in the course, without you actually having to read it. I am planning on, I don't know whether I'll do a video or just publish some notes on the relationship between Great Expectations and the rest of the stuff on the course, probably in the middle of next week. But I will give you something on Great Expectations so that you can mention it in relation to other things. There will not be a question directly about Great Expectations, so don't worry about that. The slave trade was made illegal in 1807. Slavery was abolished in the British Empire in 1837, and it was pursued by the British Empire. To make amends for having made so much money out of slavery, the British dedicated a fleet in the 1840s to pursuing other people's slave ships from other countries and liberating the people who were on board. And you should remember, in relation to this, Elizabeth Barrett and her problems with her father, because the family money came from slavery. There's an increasing rejection of blood sports and even of vivisection. Remember that Christina Rossetti was again actively against vivisection. And an idea of reverence towards animals increasingly found amongst the literati. Think about things like the tiger, the skylark, ode to a skylark, ode to a nightingale, and the windhover. Such processes were accompanied by the end of a dominance of the Renaissance tradition. So there's a rejection of patrician values. From the Roman times, there's this idea that the aristocracy are literally the first, the best people, and they are the best and natural leaders, and they are the best and natural subject for literature. Those ideas are now being thoroughly questioned, and the nobility is increasingly portrayed as ignoble. Apparently, in the work of somebody like Thackeray, I think there are no good aristocrats. And in terms of what we've studied directly, the portrait of the Duke of Ferrara in My Last Duchess, somebody who's very artistically refined, but is a psychopath and a tyrant. So there is this rejection of all things that come from the Renaissance in one sense, especially the patrician values. But at the same time, there is a great anxiety about what it means to be a gentleman or a gentlewoman. And we can see that in Jane Eyre, and we see it even more in Great Expectations. Do feel free to interrupt and ask me a question. So, the values that come out of the American and French revolutions are, to some extent, the tenets of Romanticism. Talk to me. There you have some which should coincide with what I'm saying. I found this slide, and I like the picture, after I'd written my tenets, so you can see to what extent they coincide or not. The first one is oneness and pantheism. The universe is a single unified whole, and all life is connected and valuable. That idea of oneness we saw, for example, in The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, the idea of killing the albatross gratuitously is a moral crime. Rationalism radically falsifies reality by breaking it up into disconnected, lifeless entities. And of course, that is an accusation that you could carry on into the Victorian educational system, which to some extent we have inherited. Nature is full of different expressions of deity. So from this, we get the interest amongst the Romantics in Hinduism and all of those ideas of polytheism. Another tenet of Romanticism refers to emotions, dreams, and visions. We should heed our emotions rather than trying to be logical and rational. The subconscious offers insights beyond the reach of rationalism. And here it will probably be a good idea to mention negative capability. Whose idea was negative capability? Who talked about negative capability? Negative capability is one of our key concepts. You have to be able to talk about negative capability. No? Keats. The idea that you can appreciate something without fully understanding it, basically. If you go back to the Keats notes, you will find a page full of definitions of negative capability. You should be aware of that. The consequences of rejecting rationalism is accepting our subjective experience. And all of this can be seen as a reaction to neoclassicism. Another tenet is the value of wild nature, a source of inspiration, wisdom, solace, and regeneration, especially in its sublime aspects. Oneness with nature allows the individual to connect with eternity and to escape the decay of mundane existence. The sublime in nature meant one could lose oneself and escape time. And a lot of this emphasis can be seen as a reaction to the Industrial Revolution. Another tenet is the value of children and the common people. Humble people and ordinary language have their own dignity. Innocence, especially in children and rustics, is a lost golden age. And this can be seen as a reaction against the soul-destroying reality of industrial labour. Think infant joy, infant sorrow. The importance of the individual. It was important to be one's own man, and yes, I'm saying man as opposed to person, because the Romantics were pretty masculine in their attitude, and not be part of the crowd. And this links in with the whole concept of the Byronic hero. This is a reaction against the anonymity of urban life. Truth was found intuitively within the individual. It was personal and unique. So there's a rejection of the ideas of some people like Locke and this idea that truth is subjective. Society was seen as an evil force that stunted the individual. The rejection of society and the appeal of wild nature meant that the locus of literature tended to shift away from the city. Transcendence. We are in a transcendental struggle against time and material decay. By perceiving the oneness of life, we can transcend mortality and experience eternity in the moment, which nowadays hippie types would call mindfulness. So, let's have a look at some of the chronology of that first period so that you're hanging things correctly. One of the problems that we have in this course is because we're looking at different movements at different times, the chronology of things can become somewhat convoluted. So our starting date can be 1789. when the French Revolution starts, the most important event in the early modern period, bar none, I think. And in the same year, Blake publishes Songs of Innocence, which includes Infant Joy. So our first poem coincides with the French Revolution. Four and a half years later, in 1793, revolutionary France declares war on Britain. 1794, the next year, Blake publishes Songs of Experience, which includes Infant Sorrow and The Tiger. And in 1795, Wesley breaks the Methodists off from the Church of England. And so the religious panorama changes quite substantially. 1797, we get Austen Wright's First Impressions, her first version of Pride and Prejudice. So you can see how that is actually in the middle of a lot of what we're talking about in terms of romantics. 1798, the big year supposedly in the Romantic movement with the publication of Lyrical Ballads by Wordsworth and Coleridge, which includes lines written a few miles above Tintern Abbey and The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. The political situation changes again in 1801 with the Act of Union, and from then on we can talk about the United Kingdom. In 1807, Wordsworth publishes Poems, Volume 2, which includes I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, also known as Daffodils. 1813, we have the publication of Pride and Prejudice, which is from the previous course, but as you can see, is in the middle of the Romantic period. 1815, the Battle of Waterloo, and Napoleon is defeated. 1818, Mary Shelley publishes Frankenstein again, which we saw last term, not this term. So, this is a book cover. I just decided to put the book cover in there. And that pretty much from 1819 is the Romantic period. And that last year is hugely important. 1819 is the year in which we see Keats writing Ode to a Nightingale, Ode to a Grecian Urn, and To Autumn. Shelley writing Ode to the Skylark and Ode to the West Wind, and Lord Byron publishing the first canto of Don Juan. So more than half of the Romantic literature that you are asked to study actually happens in that one year, 1819. So bear that in mind, if that's relevant. Nothing at all happens in the 20s, in the 1820s, apart from lots of dead Romantic poets. And we, in 1830, we get Tennyson publishing poems, chiefly lyrical, which includes Mariana. In 1832, Tennyson publishes poems, just poems, which includes The Lady of Shalott. And in 1837, Queen Victoria ascends the throne, and by enormous coincidence, the Victorian age starts. So, we can describe the 1830s as the Mariana Trench. You know what the Mariana Trench is? It's a very silly pun. But anyway. Mariana is written in 1830. Mariana Trench is a very deep channel in the Pacific Ocean. But anyway. And this is, again, the age of the machine. So, two things take place in this period. One is that there is a great democratization of literature. The Romantics were men writing for an intellectual elite, which they largely conceived of as men. By the end of the century, writers were both men and women, almost more women than men, and their audience covered a very wide demographic. Everybody could read, and most of the novels and some of the poetry in the period were printed in periodicals and were cheap and easy to get hold of. So culture, by the end of the period, was in the hands of the many. Wilkie Collins described the High Victorian Age as the age of journals, and most people encountered, as I say, literature through those journals, if it's in the case of novels, in serialized form. But at the same time, socially, this is very, very much the age of the machine. In 1829, Thomas Carlyle began a series of articles on contemporary society about the mechanical age, known as Signs of the Times. The essay developed in the consequences of machine-dominated society and machine-inspired ways of thinking and acting. Although national wealth had increased, so had the division between the rich and the poor in the industrialized cities. Worse still, a machine mindset was beginning to be applied to relationships, attachments, and opinions. My tea is here. Hallelujah. Thank you. So what we have is a situation in the 50 years between 1830 and 1880, Britain becomes immensely richer, but it takes half a century for the benefits to trickle down to the majority of the population. So during those decades, the question of progress for whom is urgent in society and in literature. And of course, you can see those ideas which are questioning the benefits of industrialization and of machines as directly related to what was coming out of Frankenstein and to all of those romantic tenets and a lot of the nostalgia about the Middle Ages as well. Thank you. The literary reaction to all of this is what was called the condition of England novel. I'll write that down. I'm sure you can understand it, but I'll write it down anyway. So in the 1840s and 1850s, many novelists reacted against the appalling conditions in the great industrial cities by writing Condition of England novels. For example, Elizabeth Gaskell's Mary Barton, 1848, and North and South, 1855, Charles Kingsley's Alton Locke, 1850, and Charles Dickens' Hard Times, 1854. There are others, but those are probably the most important ones. In 1845, Disraeli described England as two nations, the rich and the poor. So there is a general recognition. Disraeli, of course, is a novelist who becomes a politician. There is a great deal of interest in a literary sense and in a political sense in this problem of the redistribution of wealth. Of course, the Victorians are terrified that there will be revolutions like there have been in Europe at the time. While all this is going on, Robert Browning publishes Dramatic Lyrics, which includes My Last Duchess, which in one sense ignores all the problems, but in another sense responds to some of the problems of aristocracy and received privilege and these types of things. Apologies for me, my strange behavior, but I have some type of problem with my tendon or my nerve in my arm, and it's very similar to the sciatica I had last year, but in my arm. And so what I'm doing is trying to stretch my arm to try to relieve that a little bit, but I'm not going completely mad. It's just me trying to reduce pain. The High Victorian Age is the period between 1840 and 1862, and I have characterized that as Chartism, Tractarianism, Darwinism, and Bildungsromane. Bildungsromane is the plural of Bildungsroman. And so what we have in this period is the rise and then the decline in the 1850s of Chartism, this movement for democratic reforms to get the votes for, at least in the first instance, pretty much all men. And that is, and the Second Reform Act, I think, of 1860, largely solved that problem for a generation. Tractarianism. What's Tractarianism? Another name for Tractarianism? Anybody? Well, Tractarianism is also known as the Oxford Movement, and it is a strengthening of the hand of what has been called the High Church in England. So it is those people who are considered Anglo-Catholics, who are considered Catholics except for the fact that they still are part of the Anglican Church, like Newman in his first phase. And so we have the Anglican Church being undermined from the Protestant side, if you like, by the Methodists, and from the Catholic side by the Oxford Movement. And so the established church becomes considerably weaker. And about this time, there is a survey in which they discover that most people in the country do not go to church. And they're rather shocked by this. You think they'd have noticed. But we have a situation where most people don't go to church, and in some parts of the country, like Scotland, the number of people who go to Anglican churches is really quite small, unless there are more people going to dissenter churches, to Presbyterian churches and things, than there are going to Anglican churches. So there is this whole decline of faith, and an attempt to reassert that faith outside or on the edges of the Anglican Church. And part of that, of course, is related to Darwinism and the publication of The Origin of